Accession number 27185, Reel 66.
Major Barras, Reel 66. You're saying that you had a good area manager to whom you were sent.
He was adequate to the job, I'd say, because I don't think he was over demanding, because most of the stuff is decided by head office, and then everything works more or less like clockwork, really, to schedules and everything else. His job was to see it had operated all right in his areas. He'd worked his way up from being a conductor. He had a car, and I remember, I think he was very proud of the fact that he had got this far. And he was a delightful chap. I don't think he quite knew what to do with me. He used to take me round and show me things, and we'd sit in the office and chat. And then I've read it at this stage of the things, after I was nearly a year now, I got a little restive. And I put it to him and asked him to get up, put it up, that the time was now that I should have a proper job somewhere. Which they took to heart, and I soon was appointed as assistant to the general manager of Maidstone and District Motor Company, I think it was, based in Maidstone, obviously. But this meant, of course, that I could go home and live at home, and that was half the idea of trying to get down south to a company. So I was appointed there. We moved from Chipstead to Kemsing, which is just outside Seven Oaks. And from there, I used to commute every day by car. The manager, general manager, was the son of the original owner of Maidstone District, and therefore had not worked his way up through the system. He had an education, private education. He was a very nice chap and was very helpful and supportive to me. And a lot of the time I was sort of acting as an adjutant in a way, one way. I was very conscious of the fact that I was dealing with people in the various departments who knew much more about their job than I did, whereas as an adjutant I thought perhaps I knew just as much as the company commanders and other people I was dealing with. But as time went by, of course, one, you know, got used to things. They treated me with great courtesy when I first got there. I think they had to get used to me, because it's something I was totally something they'd never seen before. Everything was very staid. They were all called each other Mr. This and Mr. That. And it was an industry which was really set in its ways. There wasn't much scope, really, for original and creative thinking.
Was it more formal in that way than the army had been?
Oh, much formal, much formal. Everything was done on a routine basis. This happened at this time, and this was the way to do it. And it was always done this way, and this is the way it's going to be done again. So, apart from sort of the odd things like bringing in new buses of a different type or getting new routes or having an accident, nothing really disturbed the sort of peace of everyday life.
It was all routine.
It was totally routine, yeah. As time went by, they got used to me, and I was able then to relay what the general manager wanted to various departments. He was rather a portly gentleman, pear-shaped, I should say. He described himself as pear-shaped, actually, so I'm not saying anything he wouldn't have said. He had a heart attack, not surprisingly. And he was off for, a couple of months, I suppose, at least. And I found myself in a situation that nobody was brought in. So I was really sort of in the middle of liaison officer more than anything else. And then I used to go to see him when time he went home and was able to talk but was convalescing. So I spent a lot of the time then of talking to the heads of various departments, which were engineering, traffic, personnel, finance, and then go and see him. But of course they saw him as well. I mean, obviously there were things which I couldn't talk to him about, and I never hopefully pretended that I ever could, because that's the worst thing to do, is and then get yourself in a mess and then you've lost everybody's confidence. So that went on for a couple of months or so. And then after I was there for 2 years, actually. And I stuck it, I didn't stick it out. I mean, I found it enjoyable in the way that there were nice people to work for and I had a job to do and I was in the centre of things again. But it wasn't exactly demanding my little bit of intellect. So I felt that I ought to look around and try. I mean, I felt a bit guilty about getting out because they'd very kindly given me a whole year to take me in. But I think I was taken in as a sort of a guinea pig to see what happened. Whether or not, I suppose if I'd stayed in and proved myself, I could have either switched across to television in the end, or may have got a job at head office, which would be in a broader interest, of course, because that would cover the whole of the UK. Mm-hmm. But I started thinking about other jobs, and I wrote around to various people, I even put an advertisement in the paper, I think. Got some one or two replies, which I didn't like the look of. eventually, I saw in the paper that a chap who worked in movements in the War Office, not in the planning side, but on the actual movements side, called Douglas Wybrow, was working for a company called Channel Airbridge, which was a airline company based in Southend. So I wrote to him and said, "What any job going?" And immediately wrote back and said, "Come for an interview." I went for an interview, and he said, "How would you like to be manager down at Southend for the airline?" So I thought, "That's great. Yes, thanks very much." So then I had to extricate myself from the others, and they did understand, actually, and I think they said at the end, although they gave me a lovely send-off, complete with a sort of, they gave me a camera and a great big thing all signed by them, and they said I'd done the right thing, they thought, because I was now getting on in age, and I don't know how long I could hang around before I got anything worthwhile in that industry. So, I unbuttoned myself, and in April 62, I went down to Southend and took up managership there. Here I had a car. By now, my salary with the BET was 1,500, which was reasonable enough in those days. And don't forget, I had this magnificent pension from the army of 500 quid coming in at that stage. So it was enough in those days to get by and educate my children and keep the family going. So anyway, I went to Southend and I got this lovely American car with a bench seat in front and a radio, which was, I thought I'd arrive driving home with a radio actually getting in the car. And I took over the place. The previous manager was also been in the army, apparently, but never left his office. he got into the drink situation. I think he was required at some stage to go and answer a charge for being drunk in charge of a car or whatnot. So when I arrived there, I found that the morale wasn't particularly good. The actual way in which they were working wasn't particularly good. The way they handled passengers wasn't particularly good. And the speed with which they did things. The airline consisted, the Channel Air Bridge had a number of Bristol aircraft, which were two-engined propeller jobs. We opened up the front and put three cars in, and a crate, probably, of freight. And then the passengers went at the back. And they had this fleet. That's all they had at the moment. I think they had six or seven of them.
And were they flying to?
Well, they were flying to Calais, Antwerp. Where else were they flying to? Somewhere else. Calais. And there were three destinations. They had 70 movements a day going on with these things coming in and going out again. They were getting a bit old. And when I first went down, I went into lodgings up the road. Mrs. Lloyd, I remember. And I spent something like 14 hours out there, especially at weekends when they were exceedingly busy with these aircraft coming in and out. And now and again, they break down, of course. So when I got down there in the morning, I found the chief chap in charge of traffic. So how's things going? I get there pretty early, just started. And he'd say, well, we've got Yogi Bear stuck in the mud at the end of the runway, somebody else coming back with what was called a mag drop, which I never understood. They were always having mag drops. And once you've got two aircraft out of the timetable, you were in deep trouble.
That was your reserve, was it, effectively?
Well, there wasn't any reserve.
No reserve
at all. It was just that these aircraft were going off with passengers and cars in them, and either had to come back or got stuck in the mud. So I did enjoy myself there, because there was a big job to do.
Where were the pilots from? Were they ex-Air Force or were they civil pilots?
A lot of them were the RAF, yeah. No, the pilots obviously were good, because they all had to have their licenses. The engineers who came from a nearby engineering company, which was also owned by the same company. The whole lot was owned by Freddie Laker, by the way.
Yes.
They were all qualified. The crews, the cabin crews, were all men. When I had my first meeting with everybody there, I said, well, the summer season started and the timetable is greatly increased, because during the winter there's very little going on. I said, where are we going to get all the cabin staff from? I said, oh, we go down to the labour exchange and bring them in. And I went off on one or two of these trips in these aircraft, and I found that because they made a hell of a racket. And these guys got their uniforms. They had a Dixie of tea at the back. This was cabin meal as they went over. And I found that they were scooping it out with a mug, and then with a thumb in the tea, sort of handing it round to the passengers. So anyway, the first thing I did as soon as the season started to run down a bit, because there's not an awful lot I could do, because during the season everything just happened. You couldn't stop and change anything very much, although I did change some of the systems by which passengers were called forward or dealt with, so that there wasn't a whole lot of hold-ups. I also got people off the telex. I mean, I found one chap who was using the telex to his friend in Calais. You always just start off with, well, mate, so-and-so, you know, and then we cut down what we were able to do was to cut down messages like signals, so that they'd save a lot of money those days, like that. The other thing I did was to change all the stuff, the duty-free stuff they carried on the aircraft.
Why did that need changing? Were they carrying the wrong stuff?
Well, they were carrying the wrong stuff. They were carrying stuff which they got a good deal for, good deal from the suppliers, but wasn't all that good for selling. So I changed it all and got in sort of stuff like... gin, Gordon's gin, which they wouldn't have. The whiskey was Walker's and all the stuff which was known. Was it Walker's? I can't remember the name of the well-known, but they had stuff there which was hardly known at all and probably tasted like hell. So I changed that around. So, and of course the airlines depend a lot on the duty-free sales to improve their revenue. So at the end of the, when the season came down, I fired all the men except two, which I kept because we carried horses as well, and they were needed. And they took all the seats out and put stalls up. And then began a focus on getting some stewardesses in. And I also insisted that they stayed, because what they were doing before was whenever they got any girls in, they were all students. So they'd give them a training, and then they went. So you had to start all over again. So I got approval, God knows how, that what girls we recruited were properly trained by British United Airways, which was the mother company, so to speak.
Yes.
And then were permanent. So when we were recruiting, and I recruited them all myself, I got hold of our chief stewardess, and between us we recruited them all. And they stayed. And of course the cabin service improved, hopefully. And well, it did. The next thing that happened was they brought in what was called Carver aircraft, which were DC passenger aircraft, which were the front was taken off and the cockpit was heightened up rather like a 747 is at the moment, with the flight deck at top and a door underneath where the cars were put in. But because it was so high, you had to get a lift. So we had to get a lift, which we lifted them in. It took six cars actually, some freight and a number of passengers. And they flew as far as Strasbourg, down into Switzerland as well, Geneva. And they were fun because we had to get those on going. I went out and bought a whole lot of silver stuff, plated stuff to be used in the cabins, because nobody had thought of that. and a whole lot of other things we had to do ad hoc on the spot.
Were you able to take these sort of decisions on your own authority?
A lot of the time I did, because I was taken down there, and he just showed me around and it disappeared in a cloud of dust.
Yes.
I used to go to London and ask for this, that and the other. Now and again people would come down. Freddie Laker came once, I remember. I remember him standing there in his bowler hat, and he had sort of ringlet hairs hanging down, rather like a rabbi, swinging around in the wind. And he was going across to Antwerp, where he used to go and ask the local chap to give him some money out of the till, where he used to go off and have fun. And then there was the other chap who was chairman of the holding company, who was Sir somebody, I can't remember his name now, very nice chap, very large, well-educated individual, obviously good with finance and everything else. And I remember him standing on the tarmac there and saying, "What's business like?" And I thought, well, if you don't know what business is like, I can't tell you. But that's all, really. Nobody came down ready to tell me what to do. I had to do it all. I liked it that way, preferably, because I got the impression that not an awful lot of people knew what... You see, it was a developing industry at that time, and people were playing things off the top of their heads.
Sounds like it was rather more similar to your role in the army than at the bus company.
Oh, yes, it was, yes.
An independent command,
yeah.
Of some sort.
Oh, yes, it was totally independent, and I enjoyed it immensely because I was up the whole time going around doing this. And they were all very eager to work. An aircraft came in. Sometimes we got a foreign aircraft that came in, and we were told to handle it. And we were told if we handled it well, we might get a contract. So they all went down, they all got down to it, and I went out and was pushing bits of crate around with them to make sure that we got in. And we did get a contract on one occasion, I remember. But that's the sort of thing that I enjoyed doing, and that's the sort of thing the army teaches you, to get stuck in and get round to know people and know your staff. And gradually I got to know all of them, and their strengths and weaknesses, and which were the best ones, and which were the ones which needed either support and more training, or else changing, or else goodbye. Don't think it happened very often. I had to sack two men, I remember later, I can't remember anyway. It was, sadly, I didn't like doing it, but it was unavoidable. There was one department there which I really never understood, and that was the bond where all the booze was kept, cigarettes, and was under a very strict eye of the revenue men.
Yes. The bonded warehouse.
Bonded warehouse, yes. And I used to go in there, and then the chap who was in charge of it was very, very knowledgeable, very good, and completely trustworthy. At least I satisfied myself that he was. At least I hope he was.
Either very trustworthy or very subtle.
Yes, that's right. I don't think he was subtle. He wasn't a subtle type. However, I used to go around, and he used to explain to me what was going on, and I tried to take it all in, but it was terribly complicated. And then I used to pay frequent visits, looking knowledgeable, in the hope that he knew, as I thought that I understood what was going on. But other than that, now of course I got to know the revenue men as well, and I got to know the airport manager. I used to go and see the airport manager on many occasions to get all kinds of benefits out of him and help and doing this, that and the other. So I had a very close liaison with the airport manager. So that lasted a year. I used to drive home every weekend, and I was told that I would be probably only there for a year. And then they made me sales manager in London. I was really sorry to leave all the people, because there was a staff there of 230, I think, I had altogether. And then I had a very close liaison with the pilots and the engineers. The pilots were great chaps, they were great fun. So I was sorry to leave them all.
I mean, it sounds as though this is sort of operational work, whereas being head of sales might have been more like office work rather than...
Well, it was office work to a point. I went up there and I found myself... We had now become British United Air Ferries as opposed to Channel Air Bridge, directly under BUA, or a subsidiary of BUA. And I found myself a sales manager for both passenger and cargo. Now, cargo... I could understand passenger traffic, and that wasn't too difficult, because you then got through to all the agents, business houses, and everything else you had to do, timetabling and everything else. But when it came to cargo, the rates was a very difficult thing to understand for different commodities, different places, packing, The rates were the most difficult thing to learn, because they varied all the time, and of course you had various steps of ratings all the way up. So anyway, I had a good sales rep under me, a cargo chap, so I pretty well I think I found that he was competent and trustworthy, so I left most of it to him. I think I used to ask him, as the chairman did, house business now and again. But no, I did a bit more than that. I used to go around with him on some of his visits to cargo agents as opposed to passenger agents. And then after I'd been there, I suppose about a year or so, I was asked if I'd be passenger sales manager for BUA, which was a step up.
The parent company.
The parent company. Which brought me in direct contact with Freddie Laker, which was an education in itself.
What did you learn from him then?
Nothing at all, really, old Fred. Mm. He was a great entrepreneur. He was very good at PR. He had a way made him popular with the public. But he had not the faintest idea how to run and delegate a company. He could run a company, provided he could deal direct with his old mates down on the tarmac. But how he dealt through his managers was another thing altogether. He didn't quite understand how you, in a big organization, because BUA at that time was quite big, it was getting big. We'd just taken on getting jet aircraft, BAC-111s, and the VC-10 aircraft to come into operation as well. So there was he understood all that because he was basically an engineer.
But he didn't understand chain of command.
He didn't understand chain of command, really. He didn't know how to do it. And if you went to talk to him on a subject, he was very skilled in negotiating, because you would find if you went to talk to him about something which involved extra money, he would somehow slowly but surely get the conversation drifting across to something entirely different, which he understood and would talk to you about. And you left the room having lost the conversation on that particular subject and got no further on the one in which you went in on. So he was very skilled in that sort of way of talking you round and out. So I can imagine that when he came to sort of dealing as an entrepreneur, he was outstanding at it. And he was a very generous and kind-hearted man, actually. He used to give us he had a turkey farm, he used to give us a turkey each at Christmas. Well, you never knew until the last minute, actually, because a chap in a white coat used to come round with a naked turkey and slap it on your desk about sort of Christmas Eve or day before. So you were always with trepidation as to whether you were going to finish up with no turkeys or two. But if anybody needed any help or fell into bad ways, he would always help. He was very, very kind. He'd come up from a working class background himself, and I think he understood people who got themselves into financial trouble and things, because he'd obviously been in it himself.
He was in and out of it all his life.
He was in and out of it all his life, yeah. But he made his money on the Berlin
airlift,
yes.
He upset the other airlines, though, didn't he?
Well, he did a bit. Not at this stage, of course, as BUA.
Yes.
He later got the sack himself. And his place was taken one Bristow, from Bristow Helicopters.
Yes.
Bald-headed bullet of a man who didn't stand any nonsense from everybody and was quite a little bit of a bully in his own way. And Fred went off and started his own airline called Lake, and I think he was happier doing that. He got a small organization, much smaller organization, which he could run himself. And he ran the Laker train, as he called it, to the States, and charging much lower fares. And of course, the bigger companies who had bigger overheads and many more routes to run.
They announced the intention of putting him out of business as soon as he started.
Yes, I'm not sure that it was entirely that he wasn't successful in his own right, because I think his fares were far too low in order to be competitive. His fares were too low. It proved in the end, actually, as you'll see when I joined BCAL, that an independent company trying to compete with the big, what was then corporation companies, was in the end, you couldn't win. Because you had to charge, your fares were so low that you couldn't get a decent return. And you couldn't get the routes, which were the routes, which were the business routes, which were the higher revenue-earning routes. So you found yourself largely running holiday routes, which were seasonal and low fares. And although Fred was going, I don't know, he was going to Florida, wasn't he, Miami, which was basically a holiday route.
He flew to New York as well.
And I think he flew to New York, yeah. But in the end, he fell fat in his face again and became a consultant. Aviation consultant. We all thought that was rather amusing, actually. But he was such a nice chap. You couldn't be rude to him or criticise him at all.
Had he any sort of service background?
Yes, he was a corporal in the RAF. Ground staff engineer. That's where he learned his engineering.
Yeah.
And in fact, the company which used to do our engineering down at Southend, I don't know what it was called, but was owned by him as well. But that is something he did understand.
He understood about servicing then.
Oh, right, yes, that's. Yeah.